Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy who will grant you a mulligan, but then remind you about it the whole ride home. Ask me how I know. Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at CLT underscore golf guy, and well, let the major championship season begin. Next week, as it's referred to in my home, High Holy Days in Augusta, Georgia. More on that in a sec. This week, though, the LPGA gets things started with the A&A Inspiration out in Palm Springs. This is the tournament that basically changed the game last year. Remember the egregious four-stroke penalty assessed against Lexi Thompson on the back nine of the last round for something that had occurred the day before that someone emailed in that they saw on TV? You remember that? She had the tournament in hand. They penalized her four strokes. She wound up losing in a playoff, and because of how her infraction was discovered and its assessment, rules have been changed. This will no longer be allowed to happen again in the men or women's game. However, it's all that anybody's talking about this week out in the desert. And as far as Lexi goes, it's all anyone is going to talk about with her until, well, until she wins it. And I hope she does. Not only would it be good for the LPGA Tour, but it's the kind of thing that the golf gods tend to do to even the score from time to time. Also, Ryan Cabbage is the head men's golf coach of the Charlotte 49ers. We'll check in with him about his team as they head into the spring season's home stretch. And I mentioned the Masters coming up next week. Today, we'll hear again from an old friend, J.P. Hebert, assistant men's golf coach at the University of Texas. But as a boy, being PGA champion Jay Hebert's son, J.P. spent many a spring week in Augusta as his dad was responsible for pin placements at the Masters. We'll chat with him about those experiences and the ones he had there as an adult as well. However, we begin today with a look back at last week's WGC Dell Technologies Match Play Championship and the man who was on the call for the final match, shot for shot, for PGA Tour Radio, Bill Rozinski. Bill, I think the match play is kind of a weird event to call in that it seems for 3 days like a regular tour event until all of a sudden it's not, as overnight you go from 64 people on the range to 6. I mean, outside of team events, you never see the range get that empty on the weekend, do you?
No, I really enjoy match play. I think the big gripe these days with match play is they didn't like the format when it was one and done.
Right.
Because a lot of the guys didn't like showing up, playing one round of golf, and leaving. But now they don't like playing 3 days, and then if you make it to the final, you play, what, seven rounds of golf. So I think they're going to have to. They're going to do something to tweak it. But I like the head-on-head stuff. And yeah, you're right. There's not a lot of people on the range, especially on the weekend when you get those, the semifinals and the finals. And but I thought it was overall a pretty good week of golf. I know a lot of the big seeds never made it, but you know what? I was calling Kisner and Poulter, and when he waxed Poulter 8 and 6, I'm thinking, wow, that's almost unheard of to play as well as Kisner did. And I think he just ran out of gas against Bubba.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. You know, you bring up the pod system that they went to a few years ago, and I get the idea, Bill, that still some of the players don't seem to get it. Definitely on Wednesday, it seems that there were some that almost regarded Wednesday as an exhibition. They didn't realize that it counted as much as Thursday and Friday. Am I getting the wrong vibe, or is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think the stats prove that if you won your first match on Wednesday, you probably advanced in your pod, because if you lost, then you're facing a must-win the next day on Thursday, because then if you're 0-2, you're done. So I think a lot of guys, well, not a lot of them, but, you know, some of the field didn't realize that how important Wednesday was to win that match, get the edge. In fact, it's funny, I think Kisner may have played his worst round of golf on Wednesday. I think he halved his match with Adam Hadwin and made, I think he shot 73 on the cars, par 71. So
yeah,
he was able to get a half there. And then, of course, he turned on the birdie machine after that. But that's one thing that's so crucial to these guys. And maybe they don't realize, we had a lot of first-timers playing in match play this year. win the first match, and then you've got an edge up on half your bracket.
I want to ask you about the venue itself. I'm from Texas. I have family that lives in Austin. I've played ACC many times. I love it for what it is and what it's used for, because it's got some great risk-reward holes for match play. But this is the kind of course, if these guys were playing a regular stroke event for 4 days, they'd kill this place. It'd be like 28, 30 under, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure, because you look at what Kisner and Norin did in their match. We had four birdies in a row on the front nine for each guy, so you had to make an eagle to win a hole, which is what Kisner ends up doing on 12, the par 5. And obviously for the members, it's reversed. They play the opposite nines as front and back, and they switch it around for the match play to go the other way. But, I mean, yeah, when you're making – now, I will say this. You're right. For the venue, to see birdies – I mean, you don't want to see guys winning holes making par.
Right.
You want to see people make it, you at least earn, you know, get the birdie. So I think in that regard, people like to see it. And, you know, to me, logistically, it can be a nightmare, because you get out on where 12, 13, and 14 are, and 15's a hard. There's a lot of holes where you can just walk on one side of the fairway. And logistically, with that, and there's also an entrance out there by 12 and 13 tee. It's where people come in and out of the golf course. So it's chaos back there. Especially on the weekend, when you only got a couple of matches going on.
Well, you know, another thing that I was watching on TV that these guys don't ever have to deal with, and I forget who it was that almost was shocked to the point that he fell backwards into the water, is Lake Austin's right there, and those boats can literally come right up to the green on, what is it, 13, and it really shocked the hell out of somebody on the weekend, and I thought we were going to have somebody go down.
Yeah. You don't realize how close you are to the water over there. Like I said, it's a great. They tell you, I'll be in Hilton Head in a couple of weeks, and they talk about all the boats in Calabogie Sound for the end of the golf tournament. There were tons of boats and yachts, whatever you have on the water there on the lake. And it's very nice. And I like and you're right about a lot of the par fours. Not a lot of them, but a number of them were very easy par fours for these guys, and the risk reward at 13 is always interesting, because it played under 300 yards. It's a par four that's played over water, and some guys get out the big stick and drive it over the green. And Kevin Kisner told me, you know what, I hit 4-iron on that hole. I try to put it in a spot in the fairway where it matches up well with where the flag is on the green. I don't even think about getting out a driver to try and drive it over the green. Obviously, you've got to have a theory on how to win at match play. And Alex Norin told me the same thing. He lost to DJ in the quarters last year. And I said, what did you learn from that match that helped you this year? And he said that you don't want to give away holes. So, you plan your strategy out, like on 13. Look, if you can drive it that far and get it over the water, go for it. But if you're not, why risk it? Just take an iron, put it out in the fairway, and see what you can do with a wedge.
Bill Rozinski with PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM is our guest taking Dead Aim. We'll get to some of the final players here in a second. But during the week, from what you saw, what you called, whose game did you see and say, you know what, they're really rounding into form at the right time heading into Augusta in a couple of weeks?
Well, Norin really impressed me with his play. I thought I was watching Stenson. two Swedes who can really hit iron shots. I mean, this guy, and in fact, he should have beaten Kisner in their match on Saturday. I mean, it was, he had, or was it Sunday? I guess it was Sunday.
Sunday
in the semifinal. He had birdie putts inside 8 feet on 9, 10, and 11. He was one up at the time and missed all three of them. And he could have been 2-3 up going to 12 and really had that match in hand, and he didn't do it. But his, ball striking, iron play was really good. Kisner's actually rounded into form. He was not playing well coming into that event, but found something. I feel like, Bubba, you got to going into Augusta, the fact that he's won there and that he's already won twice this year on the tour, I would think Bubba's going to be pretty relaxed going into next week at Augusta. I like Phil too. Phil won a couple of matches, didn't make the the finals, but I thought he grinded well out there. I thought he played some pretty good golf.
See, Phil to me was a prime example of someone who looked like they took a powder on Wednesday and didn't realize what was going on, and then woke up Thursday morning and said, you know, I might want to win a couple of these things.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. So I like his game and the way he's played. Of course, he's won this year. So, and Justin Thomas, for you know, here's a guy who's really played well this year and got into this thing, and he ran out of gas. They're going to have to—I don't know about this consolation match, because I know Justin told his mom as they were playing that consolation match, and I got this from Mark Carnival, who was covering that consolation match. He went over to his mom and said, hey, look, you want to leave tonight, go ahead, because we're just going through the motions out here. And he played up until that match. He played some solid golf, so you got to like Justin going into Augusta.
I'm glad you brought up Noren and Kiz. We'll get to Bubba in a second. But, you know, when I watch Alex Noren putt, it reminds me of when I watch Adam Scott and Louis Oosthuizen swing the golf club. You look at their swings and you wonder how a golf ball has the audacity to not go where they want it to go. And, you know, even though he missed a couple of putts that you mentioned, I swear to God, every time the ball leaves Noren's flat stick, I think it's going dead center. And I think that flat stick alone, you have to have him on a short list for next week, right? I mean, he's played so well this year.
Yeah, he has. And, you know, we don't see a lot of him because he does play in Europe. But he's one of these guys. And he's one of these left-hand low guys on the putter that, you know, there's something about it. And you're right. I criticize him for missing those putts inside 8 feet, which could have put the match with Kisner away. But he made a bunch of putts before that. I mean, when you make – Kisner made 4 birdies in a row. He made 5. So, you know, the flat stick was rolling there. And I know Kisner at one point, I think it was on – and maybe the third or fourth hole, it might have been on 2. Kisner made a like a 24-footer for birdie, and Noren had 12.5 feet or something like that to have the hole, and he just drained it. So, and it was like that. That was, and I said this on the air, that if you wanted to, if somebody didn't know what match play was and what it was about, show them that match and show them how good they played and how one guy who seemingly was going to gain control of it lost it because another guy throws in a 51-footer for eagle to have the match at 12 and then goes on to win the thing in 19 holes. So, you know, that to me was the ultimate. And, it was funny because Kisner, after he beat Poulter 8-6, I'm thinking – and he was asked about this afterwards. You beat one of, you know, the king of match plays, Poulter, and you beat him. I mean, you waxed him. 8-6 wasn't even close. And he said, well, you know, I kind of actually got more pumped up about my match with Cooch. And I'm thinking, Cooch? So I know he beat him. It was close. I mean, it came down to the last hole. I understand the excitement there. But, I mean, when you put, what are you going to put down on your resume first in match play? That I beat Coocher in 18 holes? Or I beat Poulter 8-6.
Well, that may be a Georgia Tech thing that goes a little deeper than the resume might indicate. Bill Rozinski with PGA Tour Radio is our guest taking Dead Aim. I love Kisner. He's a tenacious bulldog out there. No pun intended, having gone to Georgia. I want 10 of him on my Ryder Cup teams. But I watched it here at Quail at the PGA last year, Bill. I watched it again last weekend. It just seems to me right now, on big stages with the brightest lights, he's faded. Now, am I being unfair, or do you think he could cross the finish line first at a major in the not-too-distant future?
Well, that's, you know, a question with a lot of guys. You know, when they have the chance to win a big event, can they do it? And Kisner obviously had a chance this week against Bubba to win a WGC event. And, you know, when you work for the tour, you can't say WGC. You have to say World Golf Championship. that's in the instruction booklet. You know, he had a chance, but he was terrible. Just whatever happened between the hour he had to grab something to eat and warm up again and get out and play Bubba, he just was never, ever in that match. The ball was going everywhere. Now, he tried to turn it around. You know, he made a nice putt on 10 to win the hole. 11, he made one, but then it ends up, you know, it was over on 12. So, you know, we'll see. He certainly got the game, and he's got one of these – you know, if you put he and Duffner in a match, you would have no clue who's winning because no one has any emotion out there. Same face. You know, Kiz has the chew going, got a little spit going once in a while. Duffner, you know, he's out there. You have no idea what's going through his head. That'd be a funny match to watch.
You spent some time, and I really wanted to talk with you about this. You spent some time covering the final with Kiz and Bubba Watson on Sunday, and a lot has been made of this being a different Tiger Woods out on the course this year. It appears to me that this is a slightly watered-down version of Bubba that we're seeing as well. Did you sense this following him around?
I think I had him at Genesis when he won. I think Bubba is in such a place in his life now. You know, a year ago, he wanted to quit. He had lost a lot of weight, didn't know what the problem was, playing horrible golf, and told Angie, his wife, that he thinks, you know, maybe it's time. You know, maybe it's, I've won some events, I've got majors, and she goes, no, you know, go keep playing. So he saw a doctor, found out what was wrong, so he's put weight back on. It's hard to tell. I mean, Bubba's thin as a rail anyway.
Right.
I kind of chuckle when people tell me that they, I've lost weight, and I look at you and go, where? I don't see it. But he's, I think now, I talked to him after Genesis when he won, and there was that story going around that he had said years ago that if I get the 10 wins, I'll retire.
Right.
Well, Genesis was his 10th. And he goes, I don't know if I quite said that. And they're all going, yeah, you did.
You want me to pull up the tape?
Yeah, you want to pull up the tape? But I think right now he's in a place in his life that he can compete with anybody. He can win. He's proven that twice again this year. So now he's got 11 tour wins. He's got a WGC championship under his belt now. And I would think at Augusta, he's, especially with Bubba, with his, it's all in his brain there. I mean, there's so much going on upstairs. You never know. He's probably thinking about 10 different things usually out on the golf course. But when he focuses and gets his game going and shot shaping, there's nobody better than that. It's funny watching him. If people don't see him play.
Oh, they have no idea. It almost looks like a trick shot display going on.
I was at the sixth hole at Riviera, the par three with the bunker in the middle of the green.
Right.
I'm standing up there, and I forgot what day it was, Saturday or Sunday, and I'm calling Bubba's tee shot. And it's funny because the pin was on the front right. So he hits this shot, and what he was doing was playing a big hook. So he hits the shot, and the gallery starts ducking because they see this ball coming right at him. And all of a sudden, I'm just standing there watching this thing, and it starts curving, lands on the middle of the green and kind of funnels off. It turned up to be a great shot, but people are like, they have no idea how much of a cut he can put on a ball, how much of a draw he can put on it. And certainly that is, something that when it comes to major championships, you got to be able to do the shape shots on some of these courses.
Let's play what if with Bubba real quick. Let's say he wins at Augusta National next week. That'll be 12 wins, 3 majors, 2 WGCs. No one with 3 majors is not in the Hall of Fame. Would this make Bubba a lock in your mind, or would you hold it against him that he appears to be a one-course horse when it comes to majors?
Well, if you want to win the Masters 3 times, be my guest. I'm not going to hold that against him. It's funny. Somebody brought this up. Might have been on our broadcast when Bubba was about to win, or maybe he just won, and Dennis Paulson was talking on the air, our analyst, about credentials to be in the Hall of Fame. And Dennis said, I think he's close, but I think he needs maybe one more major to, convince the voting population. I mean, come on, Couples is in. So Bubba's got, more impressive wins than Freddie did.
Yeah.
So, but I think, because his career has been different, he kind of got into his prime in his 30s, and he didn't win until, in fact, I was there in Hartford. I interviewed him when he won that first time. He was sobbing on the green in that playoff in Hartford. It was
Hartford. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's only been in the last, let's say, 8 years, 7, 8 years that he's put all these wins together. So, but, what difference does it make? And if he continues to play, I think he's one of these guys, as long as he stays healthy, and I don't see that body snapping anytime soon because he's so limber. When he gets into his early 40s, there's no reason why he can't keep winning. So I think one more gets, if he gets another major, I think he's a lock. And then I think if he keeps playing and just keeps winning tournaments, that would be good too.
That is the legendary voice of Bill Rozinski from PGA Tour Radio. And when we return, we'll check in with Ryan Cabbage, head men's golf coach at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, as he takes dead aim at 49ers Golf, presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ryan Cabbage is the head men's golf coach of the Charlotte 49ers, and we had the chance to catch up this week. Coach, when we talked before the season started, we spoke of how relatively young your roster is. As you've gone on through the season, what has proven to be the challenges in coaching inexperienced college players versus those that have a little bit of a tread on the tires?
Yeah, you always have that with the younger guys. There are not a lot of differences between the junior golf that they've played, growing up and college golf. They may see, faster greens. They may see, hole locations that may be a little bit closer to the edge or maybe a golf course that might play 7250 versus, 6950 or 7,000 yards. But there's not a huge difference with that. But it does require game management on a different level. You see things that you try to explain that this is what's going to happen, and they don't quite believe you until it happens to them, sometimes once, sometimes two times, and then they begin to understand. But there is a learning process involved with that. Unfortunately, it might take one or two times for them to go, actually, you know what, Coach knew what he was talking about from that standpoint. So that's the biggest thing, is just the, the small, relatively speaking, but at the same time a big difference. And then once guys kind of get that and they begin to understand, a lot of times the experiences that they have, as a coach, we've been to a lot of golf courses six, seven, eight times for these events. As players, they haven't, so they may not completely understand first time around. After they've played the golf course once or twice, then you see those guys, as you referred to, have a little tread on their tire. They look over at the younger guys and go, nope, actually, the guy I played with last year did exactly what coach is telling you to that back right hole location or that front left hole location. So, it's just a learning process that takes a little bit of time.
Is it an adjustment for you as well in that, I mean, you may have a year where you have a bunch of juniors and seniors and you're not having to talk as much course management or game management to them because you've had those conversations, and so you get out of practice, so to speak, and then you kind of have to reset your brain a little bit when a new group of young guys comes in. Is that an adjustment for you as well?
It is, because, like you said, those veteran guys, and it's no different than the guys, on tour. Those guys are all going to go to Augusta next week, and you see the young guys, they always want to play with the older guys, and you remember the days of Tiger playing practice rounds with Jack Nicklaus or Ben Crenshaw, and learning the little things about Augusta National. Well, now obviously Tiger's been around there enough times that he may not have to, so he's passing that information down. So as guys, as they get older and they move throughout their career here, there is a fewer times that you have to have explanation as to what to expect with a golf course. But at the same time, those young guys still need a little bit of reinsurance, not only from the older players, but from us as coaches as well. And it's something you do have to keep an eye on, because you take for granted sometimes that, he'll figure it out. With that, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So you've always got to be coaching with that.
I had a conversation with Coach DiBattista at Carolina last week, and he brought up something that I'd never really thought about, but as a parent, God, I should think about it. How big is the just adjustment to college life for the young players? How big a part of that in their maturation process is it in terms of, translating over to their golf game? Because coming in that fall, they have so much that they need to get used to just as life business in addition to being a college athlete. And shoot, you've got an international roster. I mean, it's different to visit the United States than someone from Ireland all of a sudden living here.
Right, for sure. And that's probably the biggest adjustment. And I think sometimes, We even take for granted, you know, the kids. It's easy to say, oh, well, gosh, he's coming over from Dublin, Ireland, or he's coming over from London, England. You know, we got to keep an eye on this and make sure that his adjustment period, that we do everything that we can to get him as comfortable as possible, you know, as quickly as possible. And then we take for granted that the young man from Charlotte, well, change is the biggest thing. And it doesn't matter if you're coming from Dublin or London, or if you're coming from, you know, Charlotte. Colleges change for these guys. They're living away from home for the very first time. They're having to do their own laundry for the very first time. They're trying to figure out how they're going to go grocery shopping, have time to work on their short game, you know, prepare for that exam that's coming up, and write that English paper that's due on Thursday. And that transition time is difficult, you know, and the guys that get it, some of the best players that I have seen wasn't, you know, it didn't come from the fact that they adjusted to those things we talked about from junior golf to college golf on the golf course. It's that they adjusted to the things off the golf course more quickly. You know, that they were able to manage their time accordingly, because time management is one of the biggest challenges, you know, for student athletes, and trying to figure out how you're going to get everything into 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, when you feel like that you need an extra 48 hours in a week somehow, some way, and it's just not going to happen from that standpoint. So it is important, and that's first things first, really. You got to get guys to settle in, you know, off the golf course, just with life. And I think, you know, obviously Coach DiBattista has been doing this for a long time, you know, and as all coaches, it's something that we try to work on and focus on with the kids.
Ryan Cabbage is the head men's golf coach of the Charlotte 49ers. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I've yet to come across a coach that was ever satisfied with his team's or his players' performance, but what are some things that you can say you are happy with from, you know, when we talked in October to now?
Well, I think that the, you know, Connor Purcell, you know, has continued to, you know, to improve and to be competitive. He didn't have a great week at Linger Longer, but certainly, you know, he has continued to progress, and he's doing a job from his standpoint to allow us to be competitive, you know, on a national level. You know, with that, I think some of the younger guys are starting. You know, Connor Armistead has had an opportunity. He hasn't played great when he's been in the lineup. But at the same time, he's now getting into the lineup, and he's learning and he's growing, and he'll be better for it long term. You know, with that, like you said, I don't think his coaches were ever happy. You know, my old boss and coach I played for, you know, at Auburn, he always talked about the moment that you get comfortable is the moment that you stop improving. So I think that's why as coaches it's ingrained in us to never be happy with where we are. But I think, you know, both of those guys, you know, are seeing a little bit of headway. We're starting to see some guys start to improve a little bit now. We've got to get more depth with our lineup, you know, to be able to be competitive, again, on a national level. We've got to be competitive, you know, 1 through 5, you know, 1 through 6, and then 1 through 7 on our team, you know, because as they say, you're only as good as the guy that you leave at home. So if we can get a little bit more depth, I think that we certainly can make that move to be competitive. But overall, you know, we need improvement in all areas.
I believe there's not one shot you've already made that's going to help your next one. I've always been a focus on the next kind of guy, both on the golf course and in life. Same deal with tournaments. You're about to host a tournament next weekend at Irish Creek. Tell me a little bit about the field and what you're looking for coming out of it.
The top two teams coming in, Georgia Tech will be with us, their first time participant.
Good program.
Clemson will be here. They'll actually have one of their guys will be playing Augusta National. Doc Redman won the U.S. Amateur Championship.
I was going to say, he's a little something we like to call the United States Amateur Champion.
Yeah, exactly. Just that little event that they have in August each year that with an invite to Augusta. But Clemson will be here. You know, some other really, really good programs. You know, the University of North Florida is a top 25 program. You know, the University of Kansas will be here this year. They've been back. So we'll have 15 teams You know, right now, from a ranking standpoint, 8 to 9 of those are going to be teams that if not already, you know, confirmed their spot in the NCAA, you know, championship, certainly in consideration for an NCAA postseason bid. You know, from our standpoint, you know, I just want to continue to see improvement and hope that we see improvement as we kind of, you know, make the stretch run. Can we be a little bit better in areas, you know, at Irish Creek than we were at the Linger Longer tournament, you know, a couple of weeks ago? So that's our main focus right now, you know, as we go to Irish Creek and then we go to Vanderbilt after that, leading up to the conference championship in Texarkana in a little less than a month now.
Let's talk about that. Ryan Cabbage, head men's golf coach of the Charlotte 49ers, our guest taking Dead Aim. One of the things I like about the Conference USA tournament is match play actually decides the winner, just as the NCAA does. Now, help me with the format. Is it 2 or 3 days of stroke play before you get to match play?
We actually play 54 holes of stroke play out there, and then 2 matches on the on that Wednesday. So it's a practice Saturday, play 18 holes Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, and then 2 matches on Wednesday to determine the champion. So the top 4 advance to match play.
That's what. And how many from the conference tournament advance to regionals?
So you'll either have your at-large berth, mm-hmm. You know, from the standpoint of the NCAA postseason, right, or the actual champion. So right now, I think we have 2 teams comfortably in. With at-large berths, and then a bunch of teams. You know, it's a year that, you know, there are a couple teams in the top 50 to top 60 in the country, and then from there are a whole bunch of teams between 70 and 100 in the country, which is probably going to be, it's been a kind of a 4-team league the last few years, and now all of a sudden I think we have, you know, 7, maybe 8 teams in the top 100 in the country. So it should be a pretty competitive championship. And of course, with match play, you never know, you know, what's going to happen with that. But it'll be a battle to get in the top 4. And then, you know, who knows what's going to happen, you know, once you get to match play. So we'll see when we get there.
As you start to evaluate towards the end of the season, and again, this has been a young squad, are there specific things that you tell your guys as a whole that you want them to focus on during the summer, or do you handle it on an individual basis? How much contact are you allowed to have with them anyway over the summer? I know it's
any limitations in regards to contact.
Oh, okay.
You know, with the guys. You know, one thing that we do have to consider with that are the financial resources, because we can't pay for any of the travel expenses or anything like that. And
right.
You have some guys that you know, may be able to afford to travel all over the country and play, you know, maybe 6, 7, 8 events, you know, in the summer. And then, I mean, you have other guys that it needs to be more on a local level and a regional level to minimize some of those expenses, which is, you know, that's fine, you know, either way. You know, I do like our guys to be competitive so that they can stay sharp over the summer, you know, but it does have to be handled on an individual basis as well, to make sure that guys, when they come back to campus in August, that they're not burnt out, you know, and because we hit the ground running, you know, we're scheduled to play 5 events next fall. So, you know, if guys are playing too much over the summer, they get back in here in August and you're kind of ready to put the clubs away when we actually need to be ready, you know, to be excited about what we're doing and the opportunities that we have in front of us. You know, so it does have to be, you know, handled on an individual basis to make sure, you know, that events are spaced out, you know, accordingly. So there's proper time for practice, proper time for rest, and then at the same time knocking out, you know, some competition so they can stay fresh from a competitive standpoint as well.
Ryan Cabbage is the head men's golf coach of the Charlotte 49ers. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. I was hanging out with Victor Wiggins not long ago before he went to Latin America for some tournaments down there. Of course, he was part of that team that made that great run in the NCAAs a few years ago. He reminded me of something I'd forgotten about your days at Auburn, and I can't let you go. Give me one good story about your former roommate, Jason Duffner.
You know, the thing with Jason, I had a guy ask me the other day, you know, the difference in the guys that I had seen be successful, you know, not only at Auburn but at Charlotte, just college golf in general, and what was the difference in those guys. You know, so it's not really a particular story, but just simply the passion, and that's the word I use to describe the difference maker with guys that, you know, maybe have some success junior golf, maybe have some success in college golf, and then guys that go on to have success from a professional standpoint. You know, and it is that passion, that underlying desire and drive. As I've said many times, if we as coaches are the ones that are driving the boat, so to speak, from a motivation standpoint with the guys, and I know that's part of our job, but if we are the sole motivator for our players, it's very rare that those guys are going to have success on the next level from that standpoint. And Jason was a guy that, you know, Coach Mike Griffin, who we played for and then I worked for 10 years, you know, there at Auburn. I think he would vouch for the fact that very rarely did he have to motivate Jason to go work on his game. And, you know, he was certainly a great example for the other guys on the team, and certainly a great example for me as a coach even now. You know, that's 20 years removed from you know, being in college and being on the team with Jason. But to use that example to this day, that hard work pays off. And Jason has gotten to where he is, you know, due to that hard work. And it's great to see, you know, the success, you know, and see guys be successful, you know, that are passionate, that have great work ethic. Can get there, you know, by using those things.
He's got a young squad, but that guy knows what he's doing. 49ers golf is in really good hands. Ryan Cabbage, head men's golf coach at UNCC. And up next, son of a former PGA champion and Ryder Cup captain, J.P. Hebert, takes Dead Aim at what it was like to be a boy in Augusta as dad helped set the pins for the Masters each spring. Presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. J.P. Hebert is the assistant head coach of the Texas Longhorns. His father was former PGA champion and Ryder Cup captain, Jay Hebert. And as a boy, J.P. spent a week in Augusta every spring as his father helped set the pin placements for the Masters. Look, I know these things are kept somewhat secret around there, but your dad, former PGA champion, Jay Hebert, he was... How would you describe it? Was he a consultant for the pin-setting committee at Augusta?
Well, he was for 17 years on the tournament committee, on the what they call the tees and pins committee. And so, yeah, acting as a player's consultant, they typically had a former player. He was that guy, along with a couple of members there that would serve to find the right, you know, the appropriate hole locations and tee setups for each tournament day, depending on conditions and wind direction and so forth. So I had a chance at a really early age to spend some mornings out there. And like I like to say, it's where I learned how to keep my mouth shut.
Yeah, we're going to get to that here in a second. There's a part of your life at Augusta National that I've never really asked about that I want to know about. But how did that work? I mean, he wasn't a Masters champion. How did he get that position? Who asked him to do it?
You know, he was a guy that was well-respected out there. He was a PGA champion, a Ryder Cup captain. He was a guy that played in the Masters tournament for, I think, 15 years. So he was just a guy that was well-liked and respected, and he was friends with a member there whose name I suddenly can't remember. But he was a part of the group, part of the guys.
JP, the pin placements are so traditional at that club, and with that in mind, I'm having trouble remembering a player complaining about a quote-unquote unfair placement. Do you ever remember a time when your dad's pin decisions or the committee's pin decisions came into question?
You know, Augusta National is one of those places where suddenly people don't complain anymore. it seems like people are happy to be there. It's a great week for everybody. People are generally really, really happy and having a good week. And the greens have evolved over time, really without anybody even knowing about it. But you know, for example, number 16 up to the right, that they've actually added over the years a little bit more room to where now you could more fairly put a pin up on the right side of that green. So basically the same hole locations year after year after year, but the greens have changed slightly. But it's an amazing place. It's one of those golf courses, maybe the only one, where you don't have to, you don't even have to ever play or show up at Augusta National, yet you know every hole.
Oh, it's the only one in the world that's like that. No,
right.
It's because we've grown up seeing it year after year after year. Is there you've spent more time out there than I have. Is there a fine line when you go to make some of those placements? Is there a fine line between what we know and expect and, uh-oh, that was a little too close to a subtle slope or mound? Do they get it that close to the edge?
You know, no, I think so. And I think, generally speaking, a player understands what is a little bit safer given what wind could come up, or if greens dry out kind of later in the day. You know, there are certain pins that are edgy that require a great shot. And that's just golf. That's just golf. When you get greens going, you know, running at say 12 and a half or 13 on the stimp meter, and there's that much slope, you know, for the most part, those greens are built for certain hole locations. But some would be considered more fair than others.
J.P. Hebert is the assistant head men's golf coach at the University of Texas, son of Jay Hebert, nephew of Lionel Hebert, and my old friend. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. When was the first time? What is the first memory that you have of Augusta National?
Well, I would go out there as a kid. I'm thinking I might have been 8 years old, and ride out there in a car really early with my dad, dark, before the sun came up, and he would sit me there on the back porch of the locker room, and I would just sit there, and then he'd bring me some donuts, and then he'd go back in and hang out with the guys for a while. And then they'd all come out, and it was time to kind of take a drive around the course. And I would sit in this little cart with the guy that would actually cut the hole, and his name was Clarence. And Mr. Clarence was a guy that was the only guy that they would let cut the hole. So when everything was done, he would go out there, do his little routine, cut it perfectly. And even when he retired, they would bring him back just for those tournament days because apparently he did it better than anybody.
Now, when you say cut the hole, you and I have seen this done a gazillion times on many golf courses all over the world. What was it that he did that was so special? Would he actually get out hand clippers and do something at the end? What was it that Mr. Clarence did that made him so magic?
I don't know, but he had the touch. he had the ability to have that perfect consistent cut from hole to hole, green to green. And then he had this little kind of a wooden sort of like a leveler that he would put, and he would kind of rotate it around with just the right amount of pressure to where it was just perfectly flat around the hole. He must have had something, because he was the guy that they would have do it.
This is so Augusta National. People just don't realize how Augusta National this is, that they would have a guy who was the green cutter whisperer. And that was his job. Like, he didn't have really any other major job throughout the whole year. He may have had some minor jobs, but that was his main deal. And they have guys like that at that club for little jobs all over the place.
Absolutely. He was the hole cutter.
That's so great.
He didn't paint the hole. He didn't select the hole location.
No.
But he cut the hole, and then he refilled. You know, the other side of that is to refill yesterday's hole with today's plug and have that in there perfectly, and you know.
To where you didn't see a seam, it just was...
Right.
Oh, fantastic. Now, in a typical year, when would you and your dad arrive in town? Would you stay the entire week? Would you get there Monday? Would you get there on Sunday before? What was your routine?
No, it's usually just maybe a day prior, maybe 2 days at the most. Jack Lupton was the member that I couldn't think of earlier. He was a good friend of my dad's, and so they spent some time together. They would catch up. He would obviously hang out with a lot of his friends that may have been past champions. He was not a past champion. But it's just a really, really special week for everybody. Yeah, like I said, everybody, Masters Week at Augusta National is in a good mood.
Oh yeah, no, it is. It is a celebratory week. I think that's a good way to put it, because it for a couple of years it got away from this, but it's gotten back. That it was the reward for winning the year before on tour, and so this was your big prize, and so I think that's a great way to put it. JP Hebert is our guest taking Dead Aim. He is the assistant head men's golf coach at the University of Texas, and his father, PGA champion Jay Hebert. Now, you were raised on Champions Golf Club, in a home run by a PGA champion, and at a club run by another PGA champion. So from a young age, the etiquette of a high-end club, it was just part of your DNA. That being said, Augusta National's a different place altogether, and you and your brother Jason were, after all, boys. What were you allowed to do? What were you told to do? Was it just what you described, a sit on this step, then go out with Mr. Clarence, and then you come back? Or did you guys have some fun, some run of the club a little bit before the tournament started? What were you allowed to do?
You know, when we would go out there, we're talking back in the probably late 70s and then throughout the 80s, right? So really more freedom. I think we had more freedom as kids back then.
Oh, I know you do. I know you did.
And so it was kind of like, well, drop me off, and then I'm going to look at the pairing sheet, and then I was going to meet my mom at the tree there behind the clubhouse at about noon, and then we'd have lunch and figure out what we're going to do from there on. And, even today with the technology we have, cell phones are not allowed out there today, and back then, we obviously didn't have them. So, but yeah, I just kind of ran around, did my deal with a kid. The one of the years in the early 80s, 1981, maybe 82, I can't remember, it was the year that Tom Watson won, one of those years. And I decided I was going to watch Tom Watson round one, Thursday. So I picked him up on the first tee box, watched him hit every shot for round one. Then I watched him every shot for round two, every shot for round three, and every shot for round four, and he won the tournament, which I think is pretty incredible. And I haven't even told him. I haven't ever seen him since telling, but I watched him every single shot as a kid that I was probably 10 or 11 years old. And I mean, I'm talking like ran along, was right there for each shot. That was a pretty cool memory.
JP, later you got to be involved again with the tournament as a grown-up with, I believe, the online coverage. Now, what did you do, and how did that job come about?
Right. I was working for CBS, and I was working on the production of some of the extra bonus coverage that they would do. So they produce small shows such as like a marquee grouping or hole 15, 16, or, something that you could watch more specific to just the main show. So I had already been working with Golf Channel as an associate producer, as a spotting producer, basically kind of like a golf guy within a truck full of TV people. And so the same thing that I worked at the Masters for probably 5 years as a spotting producer for hole 15 and 16. So literally would sit there in the truck, talk to people on the ground, and to help set up every single shot that was shown live on hole 15 and 16. You know, something you could watch in your office or DirecTV or CBSSports.com.
We spoke about this a couple of years ago, and I promise this is the only mention of David Ogren's name I'm going to make. But you had a front row seat, so to speak, with the infamous Tiger Woods drop at 15 when he hit the stick. It ricocheted into the creek in round two. What year was that? Was that 2010?
I'm not really sure. I think it could have even been later.
Later than that. But anyway, this was the big...
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Ricocheted into the creek in round two. He was charging up the leaderboard at the time. Did you have a sense that something wasn't right as it was happening in real time?
No, I didn't. And even though that was one of my holes that we were covering, and so, you know, kind of watching it through a television camera and through the monitor, I wasn't really able to notice it. To me, it didn't stand out that he just dropped it, you know, a step or two behind the original spot. So, and I really think that at the time, it seemed like in the middle of the fairway, there was an official out there for other groups, for other players that had to take relief from the hazard.
Right.
Yet when Tiger was there and that moment was so big and so strange for that ball to hit the pin and then come back in the water, I don't remember an official actually going out and approaching Tiger to help him. I mean, because I just think that moment was so unusual and kind of an intimidating moment maybe for an official that was just there.
Yeah.
Maybe treating Tiger in that situation differently than it would just be any other player coming through there.
You know, maybe I'm naive, but I've been around the game a while and around these great players, and I truly believe in my soul that not one of them intentionally breaks the rules. I just don't buy it. That being said, I do think that some of them are more aware of rules than others, and I certainly think that Tiger is as attuned as any. Did it surprise you that he wouldn't act in accordance to the letter of the law, or that he would have made that error?
You know, I think in the heat of competition sometimes, I think sometimes that we forget about the little things, that we're not actually stopping to realize what is really happening. I think it's easy to make a mistake like that in a moment like that. I think anything's possible, but I can't imagine him, you know, just forgetting. But I think the bigger question is afterwards, when that had already been brought to his attention, that then that's the point where a guy has the opportunity to make a decision based on what he thinks is right. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, we've seen this in other players, right? It's like, I think it's clear that at the moment they weren't trying to cheat. They just forgot to do something. But then after the fact, okay, then what are they going to do? You know?
Yeah. J.P. Hebert is the assistant head men's golf coach at the University of Texas. He's our guest taking Dead Aim, and as such, we'll get you out of here on this. Texas, Oklahoma State, Baylor. You pointed out to me before we started this interview, Texas Tech is playing well this year. The Big 12 is brutal. Number one, how do you feel about your team heading into the home stretch of the season? And how many of your conference teams would you expect to see make it to the NCAAs?
Well, I would expect to see at least six.
Wow.
Of six of the 10 teams that we have in the Big 12. It's a competitive conference, especially for golf right now.
It may be the best golf conference in the country. In fact, I think it is. You can't really make an argument against it.
Right, right. And so we are very, very, you know, we love it. We love being a part of a strong conference. We think that makes us better. It makes us a little prouder of our conference. And we are very proud to have won our Big 12 Conference Championship each of the last 5 years. That's hard to do.
It is.
This year, our conference championship is at Southern Hills in Tulsa, April 23rd to the 25th. And we're obviously going to have our hands full this year. Oklahoma State is playing great golf. Baylor, Texas Tech, Oklahoma, TCU, they're all good teams. So
the conference tournament is at Southern Hills, and I think the NCAA's is at Oklahoma State's home course, which, if memory serves, and you've played it, to me, that's one of the hardest damn courses in America that no one talks about. I mean, there's players. Pete Uihlein was an amateur champ who came to school at Oklahoma State and couldn't qualify his first semester on that course.
Right. It's a really difficult golf course. It's an intimidating golf course. It's one of those courses that's a Fazio course that's cut through basically a forest. And right and left is no good. So it's an intimidating golf course. It's a very good one. It's in good condition. It sets up really well for a championship, and I know that it will again. But it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Assistant head men's golf coach for the Texas Longhorns, son of PGA champion Jay Hebert, nephew of PGA champion Lionel Hebert, and most important to me, my friend, that's Jean-Paul J.P. Hebert. I'd also like to thank Charlotte 49ers head coach Ryan Cabbage and Bill Rosinski from PGA Tour Radio for their time and perspective this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Hey, weather-wise, Chamber of Commerce spring weather for the QC this Easter weekend to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt our souls and break our hearts. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week. Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors.